The term urban legend, is that familiar to you? It's a term that speaks of a story that makes its way around and is oftentimes accepted, and yet its validity is somewhat in question. I was first introduced to an urban legend back in college. I went to a Bible college, and we had a Christian radio station, largely just covered the campus. But about that time, a letter started making its way around, allegedly from Madeline Murray O'Hare. I don't know if that name is familiar to you, but she is one of America's first most outspoken atheists. She is largely responsible for getting prayer out of school. And the letter suggested that she now had a case in front of the Supreme Court that was going to require the FCC to outlaw all Christian radio, television, anything over the airwaves. It, of course, caused a bit of a stir. The problem was it wasn't true. In fact, the interesting thing to me is I just a couple years ago got exactly the same letter in an email that she was still up at it. And it's amazing the way urban legends move. Today, our urban legends have moved largely to the internet. In fact, I came across one that I thought was fascinating. It was a video of three cell phones sat on a table with four kernels of popcorn in the middle. They called the three cell phones and the popcorn popped. Of course, the idea was that we all know that cell phones emit this harmful electromagnetic force, and if it could pop popcorn, what exactly is it doing to your brain? Well, the problem is that it was put out by a CEO of a company that sell little Bluetooth adapters that you're supposed to wear, and he was simply trying to create a market for his Bluetooth. I would suggest there are what I would entitle spiritual urban myths. Maybe one of the biggest really was kind of brought to us in 2003. I don't know if you remember back in the latter part of the 1990s and the early part of the 2000s, Las Vegas, Nevada was trying to advertise themselves as a family vacation spot. In fact, they were advertising themselves to be the best family vacation one can find in America. It wasn't going well, and in 2003, they came up with a new advertising slogan. It was, "What's done in Vegas stays in Vegas." The idea is, if you want to enjoy yourself, go to Las Vegas and you can do whatever you want and no one will ever know. We want to believe that. In fact, I would suggest that one of the greatest dangers to our spiritual life is the belief that what I do in private will stay private. If you have your Bibles, would you go with me back to the book of 2 Samuel? We're making our way through this incredible look at this amazing man of God. The books of 1 and 2 Samuel, written by the same narrator, shares with us in the first volume what God was looking for in a king. And as we see in the last half, David is revealed to us as this man after God's own heart, this individual who lived as God wanted all of us to live. We came to the second volume in chapter 1. We began to see David's life, and we begin to look at all of the adventures David has. And last week, if you were here, we were in chapter 9, and I would argue chapter 9 is the zenith of David's life. He has now brought rest to the land of Israel. He has largely driven out all of the enemies, and there is peace, there is prosperity. Israel is expanding its borders to the farthest point of any time in its history. David has brought the Ark of the Covenant to the city of Jerusalem and has made a tabernacle, but is hoping to build a temple. God says no. And David says, that's all right. And last week he demonstrates, he really plays the part of God, and he shows grace to Mephibosheth. And I'll be honest, I really wanted to end there. Move on to the next story, go on to a different book, begin to do a different study, because in chapter 11, the entire story changes. And the last half of 2 Samuel is anything but peace, prosperity. It's brothers raping their sisters. It's brothers murdering their brothers. It's sons rebelling against their dad. It is filled with all of the things we wish we didn't have to read about. And I would suggest it begins because David believed what he did in private stayed there. as we come to chapter 11, it begins in verse 1 by saying, in the spring of the year, the time when the kings go out to do battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all of Israel, and they raged against the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. Just a quick little bit of background. He's trying to tie it back to chapter 10. The narrator is, in chapter 10, you'll remember, David offered grace to Mephibosheth, but he also offered grace in chapter 10 to the Ammonites, and they reject it. They humiliate the emissaries, and they come back, and David lays siege to the city. And Palestine is such that it's difficult to conduct war during the winter. But the springtime brings with it the spring harvest in Israel. The winter wheat is being harvested, a wonderful opportunity for an army to go and take the enemy's food and besiege a city. But we are told that David does something he has never done to this point. David chooses to stay in the city of Jerusalem. We're going to, in a minute, look at David's failure, but I really am convinced that David's failure is not an isolated event. It didn't just suddenly jump up and bite him. I'm convinced that the narrator wants us to understand that there is a progression that David takes, and I would suggest a progression most of us take as we slowly spiral down to where all of us are capable of committing the same things David does. But it begins with this complacency. David has always been on the lead. He's always been in battle. But let's face it, sieging is really a difficult task. I mean, you put your army all the way around a city, and then you wait. And you wait maybe weeks, maybe months, maybe years. You have to sleep the whole time in a tent, on the ground. It's not very comfortable. It's not very exciting. It really would be a whole lot more comfortable just to stay in the palace. In fact, we're going to see as we get to verse 2 that David is so comfortable that in the middle of the afternoon, he's taking a nap. He's lounging on the couch. He's enjoying life as king. And David is beginning to become complacent. But there's a second step in his downward spiral, one that's, I must admit, is a little uncomfortable. As we've been going through the life of David, my wife has more than once made the comments, why doesn't God say anything about David's desire to have many women in his life? It's an interesting question, and the reality is polygamy is something that I am convinced God never intended. That in the created order is one man, one woman for life. As you come to the New Testament, as God will send out regulations for those who will lead in the church, he's very clear that it is a husband of just one wife. But why was polygamy allowed? I'm not sure I can fully explain the answer. I think to some degree, God, for the hardness of the Israelites' hearts, allowed divorce, which Jesus says was clearly something God didn't want. And I think to a large part for much the same reason, he allowed polygamy. But as you begin to look at David's life, you begin to see that David had a few wives. If you go back to chapter 3, as David is established as king over, first of all, Judah, they give us a bit of a summary, and they list six of David's sons. Interestingly enough, all six are from a different wife. Several of these women, I would guess most of us have probably never even heard of. But David has at least seven wives, because if you notice, Michal is not up there. Michal is the first of his wives. And so David has at least seven wives. And then you come to chapter 5, and David becomes king over all of Israel. He moves the capital from the city of Hebron up to the city of Jerusalem. And thus he feels it necessary to add to his harem. The narrator makes an interesting statement. He says he has more concubines. Do you know what a concubine is? That's a term that is used throughout the Old Testament from time to time, mostly when it's talking about the kings. A concubine was simply a woman who was, shall we say, of humble birth, had few assets to her disposal, and would sell herself to provide sexual favors to her husband as long as he provided for her. Her children wouldn't be given any of the inheritance. They weren't official children. They were just simply female slaves who would enter the possession of a man. They would be required to be faithful to him, but him, obviously not to them. And David wants more concubines and more wives. If you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, we looked at Deuteronomy chapter 17 when we were on the story of Saul as the nation of Israel asked for a king. And in Deuteronomy 17, God says that when they come into the land, the Lord your God is giving you all and you possess it and dwell in it. And then say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations that are around me. You may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers, you shall set a king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. And then he lays out three requirements. The first is the king shall not amass horses. He shall not acquire many horses. Why? Well, in the 10th century BC, a horse played much the same role as our tanks do. They were a sign of military power. In fact, in several of the Psalms, the psalmist David amongst them will say, some trusted in horses, but we trusted in the Lord our God. God wanted to make certain that there was never this standing military that everyone could say, whoa, they have the biggest army. Of course they're the strongest nation. No, they wanted everyone to know it's not because they have this great army. It's because they have this great God. And so God said kings shouldn't amass horses. And to the best of our knowledge, it doesn't seem David did. The third requirement at the end is that you shall not acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. There is a temptation with wealth to find our meaning, our pleasure, our fulfillment, even our security in money. And God says, I don't want you trusting in money. I want you trusting in me. In the middle there, he says, they shall not acquire many wives. I don't know if this is true of you, but I wish the Bible were black and white sometimes. What is the definition of many? Well, if you compare David to Solomon, Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. David didn't have many. He probably only had 30, 40. I mean, that's not many wives, right? I don't know what the definition of many is. But I would argue that when you get to 10 to 20, it is many. And David crosses the line, I am convinced, and there's a fascinating truth here. Physical pleasure is never satisfied with enjoyment of the pleasure. You're hungry, you go home and eat, and you're good for life, right? You never need another meal. Everybody knows if you eat, it satisfies your pleasure and you're good, right? It's not the way it works. Physical pleasures always want more. And if you had two cookies today, you're going to want three tomorrow and soon four and then five. The same is true of sex. If I could just satisfy this desire with one beautiful woman, that would be enough. Well, okay, maybe two would be good. Okay, maybe three. David is now probably 50. All of his previous wives, they're old. I want something young and attractive. It never ends. And it soon consumes you, as it will consume David. He begins this death spiral as he gives in to his complacency, his polygamy. But I'm convinced that part of David's problem was prosperity. For 30 years, David lived an incredibly poverty-stricken life. He slept with the sheep. He lived in the caves running from Saul. He tried everything he could do just to survive, and he was as faithful as any man perhaps has ever been. And he gets in the palace, and life becomes easy, and soon the need for faith isn't so obvious. Back in 2006, we went through the book of Philippians, and if you remember how Philippians ends, it ends with one of the most famous verses. I'm sure you've seen it on advertisements printed often. It says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. If you go back and you look at the immediate context, the verse just prior to that, Paul says that I have lived in want and I have lived in wealth, and I have learned how to be content in either. Christ is able to give me strength to do either. And I think the natural tendency is most of us conclude what Paul is saying is it is possible through the strength of Christ to be content when you have nothing. When I finished the sermon, I was leaving and Tyson Guthrie came up to me and asked a question that I must admit I had never considered. He said, I wonder if what Paul is saying is that the strength of Christ allows you to be content in wealth. It's easy to be content when you have nothing. It's really hard to be content when you have everything. All one needs to do is examine our society that is as wealthy as any in the history of the planet Earth. But are we the contentest society ever? The most thankful society ever? The happiest society ever? I read a survey not terribly long ago that the happiest people in America are the Amish. Things have a way of making us discontent. And I really think part of David's problem was he was sitting in the palace enjoying all of the pleasures of being king. And he falls. The story can really be broken down in really five ways. It's really David's relationship to the five main characters of the story. We're not going to look at chapter 12. Really, chapter 11 and chapter 12 are a single story. But for the sake of time, we're going to leave chapter 12 till a couple weeks from now. But the story begins with David and Bathsheba. Then it's David and Uriah. Then it's David and Joab. And as I was thinking about it this morning, I really think I ought to reverse that. It's not David and Jehovah. It's Jehovah and David. And then finally Nathan comes. But let me just get to the story as we begin. In verse 1, it says, "It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and was walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful." Can I just make a couple quick observations about the story? The first thing that really hits me is the narrator is radically different than any Hollywood writer would be. If this were a Hollywood script, which, by the way, it has been on several occasions, the sin of David would be the focal point of the story. But I find it fascinating that as you go through the story, the narrator simply says, he saw the woman bathing, he lay with her. That's the sin. That's all the text he dedicates to it. He doesn't give us all of the details. He doesn't try and paint this incredible picture. In fact, what he tries to paint for us is the great pain it brings, not the great enjoyment he finds. The sin is very small. But the second thing I want to point out is many of the people who I read and looked to and listened to make a big deal out of Bathsheba. In fact, one of the applications that I heard on several occasions is that, well, whether or not Bathsheba was intentionally trying to seduce him or accidentally trying to seduce him, she was obviously at fault. And they go on to say how that women need to be careful on how they dress because men are visual characters. And even though you may not realize you're seducing him, you may be. May I suggest the narrator goes out of his way to make certain that blame doesn't fall on Bathsheba. This isn't Bathsheba's sin. This is David's sin. In fact, he goes on to tell us that she was bathing, and we think of a bathtub and sitting out, frolicking in the enjoyment of the moment, but that's not what the author says. This was her purification. That probably doesn't mean a lot to us. We're not Hasidic Jews. We didn't grow up in a system in which, after the monthly cycle, women were required by law to purify themselves. And part of that process was a bath. I think what he's trying to get us to understand is she was faithful to the Mosaic law. She was carefully doing exactly what God had asked her to. And if you put it in its context, you go back to the time David built, most of the houses had, as I understand it, privacy fence. They didn't have running water like we have. They didn't have indoor plumbing. And so it wasn't at all uncommon to have a little privacy fence where your bathing would take place outside of the house. And your neighbors wouldn't see. The only person who could see was somebody who was elevated above you, peeping down over your fence. I think we can say David is a peeping David, if you will. But secondly, I find this fascinating. David sends messengers, not a single man. She's a young lady, undoubtedly. If she's trying to seduce the king, does he really have to send multiple people to take her? I mean, let's be honest. If you're about to commit, in the Hebrew culture, a capital offense, immorality was punishable by death. Do you want more people than absolutely necessary to know about it? Why would you send multiple people to get her? Could it be because you're fearful she might resist? And as king, you're not going to allow that. But you say, wait a second, there's no hint she resists. Well, put yourself back in the culture. I don't know if you remember David's first wife, Michal. I don't know if you've thought about her story much, but it gives you a little insight into the role of womanhood in the 10th century BC. David kills Goliath, and he gets rewarded by one of Saul's daughters. She's given to David in marriage. Okay, arranged marriages, they still happen today. That's not terribly unusual. Well, that's only part of the story. David now becomes a fugitive of the state. He's running from Saul, and so what does Saul do? Saul says, Michael, you're no longer married to him. You're married to somebody else. Well, wait a second, Dad. I still have a husband. No, you don't. She had no choice in the matter. She gets given to another person. And then David is chosen to become the king of Israel. And what is his first request? Go back and read chapter 4. He says, I want my wife back. Well, you can't have her, David. She's married to somebody else. Doesn't make any difference. In fact, if you read the story, her husband is going along trailing as Michal is given back to David because women had no say in the matter. If the king says, Bathsheba, come, you went. She goes, and you get a little insight into what David's real idea is. I think it's interesting as they describe Bathsheba. Normally, you are described by your lineage, your heritage, your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents. They describe Bathsheba, David, just so you know, she is the wife of Uriah. David, you're the king. You can have any beautiful woman you want who's not married, but this woman is married. But David brings her in, lays with her, and then just sends her off as if nothing happened. And it would have been the end of the story had something not gone awry to David's plan. We don't see that David brings her in and wants to marry her. No, no, just the evening of passion. Now go get out of my life. I enjoyed you. I'm done with you. Go back. And then she sends message. David, I'm pregnant. David is now faced with a real problem. The fact that she just had her purification tells you there's no chance. She had just finished her menstrual cycle. There's no chance anyone else is the father. David is. Will he confess his sin or will he attempt to cover it? And David chooses the latter. And the story quickly switches from David and Bathsheba to David and Uriah. And the reality is we really don't know much about Uriah. In fact, I would suggest we know nothing about Uriah. The only other place we read about Uriah is in chapter 23 of 2 Samuel, in which he's listed last amongst the mighty men. But interestingly enough, there's no background. Many of them, they killed 800 people with one sword. And all of these stories, there's nothing shared about Uriah. And as I was studying, I must admit, I have to wonder, was Uriah considered a mighty man because of this story, not because of accomplishments on the battlefield? Because Uriah is going to demonstrate an amazing commitment to his God, to his commanders, to his men. Even David didn't have. Anyway, David sent the word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. It wasn't uncommon. They didn't have all of the cell phones and communications. They had carriers. And so David is in essence saying, Joab, I want an update on how the battle is going. And why don't you just choose Uriah and send Uriah back to me? And so Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah came to David, he asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. And then after all the preliminaries are done, David turns to him and says, you know, you're here. Why don't you go and have sexual relations with your your wife? This is code. And Uriah understands it clearly. He knows what David is saying. And David says, seeing you were so kind to come all the way from the battlefield, why don't I give you a present? We're not told what the present is. But I suspect the present was to make the homecoming even more inviting, to make certain that somehow Uriah did in fact sleep with his wife, and then when he slept with his wife, she would give birth, and okay, so the baby would maybe come, I don't know, 8 months, but hey, babies are born premature. No one's going to question a one-month early baby. It's not that big a deal. No one's even going to know, or so David suspects. But Uriah, Uriah slept at the door of the king's house, and he went with all of the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. The servants of his lord probably aren't the cook, the maid, the house cleaner. Most likely those servants are fellow soldiers. They're David's bodyguards. They're the ones who slept at the house of, or the door of the palace to make certain David was protected, and Uriah chooses to sleep with them, and he refuses to go down. And so in verse 10, when they told David Uriah did not go down to his house, David brings Uriah back and he says, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down into your house?" And Uriah says to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths, in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing." As far as I understand, there is no command in the Torah, in the books of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that prohibit having relationships with your wife during wartime. But if you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 21, there's the story of David is fleeing from Saul, and he runs out of food, and he goes to the tabernacle, and he asks for food, and the high priest says, "The only food that I have is the food that was set apart for the priests," and David says, "Well, give us that," and the priest asks, "Well, have you all refrained from relationships with women?" And David says, "We have," and it seems as if it was something David put in play. You need to be serious about your work as a soldier. You need to commit wholly to this and forget about family until you go home and then enjoy family. And Uriah lives up to David's standards better than David does. Well, strike one. So what do I do now? David decides to take a second approach. And so David says to Uriah, "Well, remain here today also. And tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on the couch with his servants of his lord, but he would not go down to his house. David thought, maybe if I get him drunk, if I remove all his inhibitions, maybe if he's plastered bad enough, he will do what I want him to. Not what he's committed to, but unfortunately, Joab is a better man drunk than David is sober. And so David, striking out twice, won't give up. James, in James chapter 1, talks about temptation and how that we are all tempted when we are lured and enticed by our own desires. And he makes this comment. He draws a graphic image that lust, when it is given into, it is conceived and gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. James says that once you give in to lust, unless something radical happens, the end result is death. Once we say yes, it becomes increasingly easier to continue to say yes until we are utterly destroyed. And that is exactly what transpires in David's life. In fact, David now turns to Joab. And in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. David is so confident in the righteousness of this soldier that he can send a letter saying, "Kill this man," and knows he won't open it and read it. Uriah comes, and in the letter he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the harshest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die." And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out, and they fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, "When you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger arises, and if he says to you, 'Why did you go so near to the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Ahimelech, the son of Jehoshaphat? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Tezbez? Why did you go so near the wall?' Then say, 'Your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also.'" So the messenger comes, and the messenger went, and he comes to David, and told David all that Joab had sent him to tell. And the messenger said to David, "The men gained the advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servant from the walls. And some, not one, some men died." David's plan was to kill one. Didn't work out that way. He killed many. He is not just a murderer of one. He is now a murderer of some men. All in an attempt to cover his sin. But we're not done yet. David continues the deception. He continues to enjoy it. And everyone knows that this happens. And then finally Uriah heard that the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, and she lamented over her husband. And when the period of mourning was over, the incredible knight in shining armor, David sweeps in. Remember back in chapter 25 when Abigail, her husband died, the kind, loving David sweeps in, and just not because he gained anything, but because he's such a nice guy, brings Bathsheba to live in his house. And then, amazingly enough, he even is willing to father a child by Bathsheba. What an amazing man David is. Or so everyone looking on the outside would have thought. But do you know who has been absent the entire story? You don't read once the name of God until the final word of the chapter, in which it concludes by saying, "But this, the thing that David had done, displeased the Lord." David thought he got away with it. David thought, no one saw. Nobody's going to do the math. So the baby comes early, 8 months. No one's going to question that he wasn't just simply doing his kingly duty to continue on Uriah's line. He was being kind. Everyone but God. As we will see, this sin will dramatically alter the book. David, as we'll see as we come to chapter 12, is going to separate himself from Saul in his willingness to confess his sin, and he paints for us an incredible picture. In fact, several of the Psalms will be written at this moment as we see the most beautiful picture of what confession is. God will demonstrate his mercy towards David. It was a capital offense, both the immorality and certainly the murder, but God says he doesn't have to die. God forgives him. That doesn't mean all of the consequences are gone. David's life will be characterized by incredible problems because he thought what he did in private would stay in private. The reality is, each one of us this morning are tempted by the belief that as long as no one sees, I'm okay. There's one who sees all, and one whom all of us will one day answer to. The question is not, are we sinners? But are we living in such a way that we remember God sees all? I don't know where you're at this morning. I don't know where your life is, but I suspect some of us, maybe many of us, are entering that spiral in which we are beginning to set aside the things that we should be doing. We're fulfilling the physical pleasures. We're heading towards comfort, and we're headed on a path that's leading to destruction. May I challenge you, the time to stop is now. Some of us maybe have already gone too far, and it is an incredible truth and a wonderful reminder. And as we get to chapter 12, David will receive forgiveness. In fact, this morning we gather around the table and we remember for certain the incredible suffering of Christ, but we also remember that it is an incredible reminder that Christ does forgive. And we have the incredible privilege of gathering and examining our hearts. My guess is that if we're really honest, all of us have things we need to confess. But what an incredible reminder that John writes that if we confess, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. But it begins with the willingness to confess. As we this morning pause, I just hope as we gather around the table that we will ask, what does God see that he's not pleased with in my life? In fact, I am convinced that one of the scariest prayers, but one of the most important, is, search me, O God, and know my thoughts, and show me the ways that I have walked away from you. Sin not only hides from others, it often hides from us. In fact, I am convinced, had you talked to David just prior to the moment of his looking at Bathsheba, he wouldn't have even realized how close he was to destruction. And maybe we don't either. Father, we bow in your presence this morning, and I thank you for the story of David, and I thank you that he is a man after your own heart. I thank you that he does fall on his face and confess his sin and seek your forgiveness. And yet, what an important reminder of how easy sin is to take over each of us. Father, I pray that as we gather around your table this morning, that we would truly be willing to examine ourselves and to prayerfully and honestly ask for you to search us and to try us and to reveal to us the places in which we have failed you. And then, Lord, I pray that we would be willing to confess it, to repent of it, and to allow you to change us. Thank you for bringing us here this morning. For it is in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen.